Don't take pictures. Say after me.
Don't take pictures.
You see somebody taking pictures, you can turn or grab or anything. Serious. We're going to be very tonight to information that is not for public. It's for you. You will process it, and you will hopefully be able to deduct and take from this many, many, many more things. I'm really Jack Aldrich right here. And I'm so thrilled that our brother has come. He came because he has a special relationship with Mike. Mike Toothlin. Many of you recognize him. If you don't, you ought to meet him. Mike is going to tell you how he met our speaker, and then briefly give you some background. And then we're going to have Mike lead us in prayer. And then our speaker will be speaking from back here because of the computer connection. But you won't miss him. Got it?
Got it.
Mike?
Thanks, John. Do I need this? I guess, okay, we're fine. Never mind. Sorry, Brian. Hi. Yeah, my name is Mike Knudsling. I know a lot of you here. I'm going to introduce Philip Williams because Philip's been a friend of mine for the last 7 years. And our connection is, just like the rest of you, many, probably all of you are aware of what happened in 2010. Video came out on the news that some explorers from Hong Kong, the Noah's Ark Ministry International, good believers, had sent back video to the world of a find of a wooden object on Mount Ararat that they thought could be nothing else but Noah's Ark. They weren't saying it was for sure, but it was difficult to imagine it was anything else. And I was, as most of you were, I was slobber-knocked, because it's Ararat, the Bible says pretty clearly that's where it would have landed. And so I was devastated the next day when it came out that it was called a hoax by someone within the evangelical community. And I was devastated. But I got on the internet and I got a hold of Clara Way, who was a spokesperson for Noah's Ark Ministry in Hong Kong. And I asked her what was up, and she said, "Well, if you want to talk to us personally, we're going to be at the Southern Evangelical Conference Apologetics, or Southern Evangelical Seminary Apologetics Conference in Charlotte." So I drove down there, and I met all of them. I met Panda Lee, the climber who got in there in 2008, and the rest of them who made the trip in 2010 at great risk to themselves, great expense. And I realized these people are reliable witnesses, and the video is not a hoax. And that's when I met Philip, because Philip, I came to find out, was instrumental in bringing them there, and he basically began defending them against these ongoing charges that to this day are still out there, that this was a hoax. Well, to make a long story short, I then got a hold of Philip's book, which I can't recommend enough, called The Archaeological Evidence of Noah's Flood. And this bonded me to him more than ever, because this is just a groundbreaking book that if you can get a hold of it, get it. It explains a lot of things. In regard to the antediluvian world, that there is an archaeology associated with it, and the immediate post-diluvian world that we really need to get in touch with. As evangelicals, we missed a lot. Well, anyway, Philip, to make a long story short, has been one of the heroes in this story, and he himself, he's no spring chicken, made a trip, a very dangerous and costly trip, more than once, to Turkey, and actually himself got inside the structure. And so I talked to Jim. I know Jim considers this find legitimate and that it has prophetic significance. I couldn't agree with him more. So we brought Philip up here from Charlotte with his friend Mark. And I give you Philip Williams. I think I'd just like to go ahead and open in prayer. Should I do that? Lord Jesus Christ, I thank you that you haven't left us without evidence. the evidence of Noah's flood is all around us, and that perhaps you are giving us no less than Noah's Ark itself as further confirmation of your word and of even of your prophetic word. We can't thank you enough for that. I ask you to bless this time now. Give Philip your words and lighten our hearts all the more with your truth. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you, Michael. I think I got a long string, and I'm going to be able to talk to you from up here instead of back there. And I'm so glad because I like to see your face and see your confused faces. The picture you're seeing up there, I'm in a freezer that looks like an ancient ship on top of Mount Ararat. And this was on November the 9th in 2014. But I want you to know I did not start looking for Noah's Ark. I started on something else. I'm not an ark searcher. I never could believe any of the claims for Noah's Ark still in existence. Just to tell you a little bit about, well, first of all, let's look at the... I hope I'm going to reach here. Okay. There we go. Just exactly, potentially, what are we talking about here? This is the founding editor of the National Geographic magazine. He made this statement in the late 40s. He's from Armenia, so he was well acquainted with the Ark. He said he didn't believe it would be found, but he said if it was found, it will be the greatest archaeological discovery in history. There's no question about that. And in his opinion, it would be the greatest event since Jesus Christ, and it will alter all the currents of scientific thought. In a word, it would reestablish the authority of the Bible in the most magnificent way. And that's why our world has changed in the direction that it's changed, is because science has replaced the Bible as the religion and authority for our present world. let's see if we can get, maybe I'm not pointing that right directly. This is not the ark that I found. This is, of course, the ark that's in Kentucky. There's Ken Ham in the middle, and Norman Geisler, who is really got the apologetics movement started in the evangelical interest. Rabbi Zacharias is one of his, and William Lane Craig are his students. And he has over 40 years, he's never backed an account of the flood or a claim for the ark, but he's put his entire scholarship and reputation behind both my explanation of the flood and also he said I've talked to five people who have been in what I believe is Noah's Ark. And then, of course, we were Ken Ham. Now, everything you'll hear tonight will not be. Ken is my brother believer with a different scientific theory, but we both believe in a worldwide flood. We believe that man has been on Earth only about 6,000 years, and I think he's with me that the flood occurred about 4,300 years ago, exactly in the biblical time frame. But other than that, other than us having, well, we have different scientific theories, but we're brothers in the defense of the Bible. This is how I got involved. I went to college. I was trained in the sciences and humanities to learn that the Bible was not true, like many of the children today. And I wanted something that was true, so I went into the hard sciences. I became a telecommunications entrepreneur, very instrumental in bringing the network, the digital switching from the old system to the, and that was many years ago, but now you're starting to get wideband and getting the benefits of it. Had to tackle the entire telephone industry when we were doing that. So I know that if you have the truth, you can change the world if you stick by it. but I had to deal with the Bible at some point because I'm a thinker, and so I actually had to read it so I could understand what is it saying, and so I can explain why it's wrong and bad and all those types of things. But when I read it, I actually found that, hey, this is wonderful. Why haven't people been explaining it like the Bible actually says? This is, I wish I could believe it. But soon after that, I could believe it in a very powerful way that set me on the journey. But it didn't answer these questions about the scientific beliefs, so I was very confused in my head. I knew in my heart what was true, but especially when Jesus is referring to the days of Noah, a Jesus who doesn't tell us the truth about the ancient times cannot be a sacrifice for our sins. So nothing really works if Noah's ark is not the actual historical truth. So I began after my retirement in 1990 to do this investigation on the Noah's flood. I didn't know a lot about it, but one of the books that was available back then was this book on the Bible and history, trying to connect the Old Testament to the Bible to history. And it would give some tantalizing evidence and then dispute them. One of the things it gave it was a flood that was discovered in 1929 in Mesopotamia. There was an ancient world that was, let me see if I can get a laser pointer. My lasers are working today. You see, this was a world that was apparently ended, and then there's a layer of mud in here, and then a new civilization afterwards. And there was, not because the Bible said that there was flood, but the text from Mesopotamia, they were talking about the flood, and they were guessing that this was the actual flood, but it was talking about a local flood. And I was reading this, and I wondered, I said, you know, what would the archaeological evidence of a worldwide flood really look like? Because we don't see those types of flood. We see only local floods. And I knew the possibility we could actually be looking at the evidence and yet not recognizing that happened. So I looked at some criteria. What would be certain, clear evidence? What would have happened to the flood? I didn't know about the geology, whether the rocks and the fish were laid down by the flood, or I didn't know who was telling the truth, but this one thing I know is that it should, like we saw in the picture, there should be a discontinuity between the civilization, antediluvian civilization, before the flood and after the flood. You should see the flood if you had some ancient cities or ancient civilizations. And the question is, did we see that? And if so, what year did that occur? And then another thing, there should be plenty of evidence of drowned people. You know, the Bible doesn't say anything about the Lord sending the flood to kill the fish, but he did talk about a wicked world. And if that was the case, I should find evidence of the people just disappearing, and we should find, the dead people. And another thing, a very simple, straightforward way of approach is systematic. If it is, where are they, and is it worldwide? The last thing is that we should see a new dispersion of people, originally coming out of the Garden of Eden and spreading through the world. That was the first one before the flood. They were wiped out. Now we should see another one coming from Noah's family. Did that happen? You know, where did that, and how did that happen? So that's how I got into now here's the world's oldest city, which is Jericho, and you see the lower right hand corner, you'll see something there that says early bronze. There was a city there, and then later, there's another city that Joshua destroyed, and they've actually found the bricks that were fallen from Joshua's time. But there was a city before that, and right between these cities, there's actually you see what it says, fine water laid silt. This is from the excavator, Kathleen Kenyon. So she's got the flood happening there, and it happens to be happening at around 2300 B.C., the very time of the biblical flood. And I wonder, I said, well, why? There's a flood there. And why? In fact, and they know the people disappear in Israel or Palestine at that time. No one had ever tried to connect this to the flood, because the archaeologists and the scholars that do this, they don't believe in the biblical flood, and they don't do that type of thing. But I had no more sense than to actually check, well, is this possibly the flood? And the other thing I found is I found all these dead people. They're in the Indian mounds not far from here in Ohio. They don't belong to the native. They're very different. They're in Stonehenge in Britain. They're the pyramids in Egypt. You've got all these graves, and they're very elaborate, and people are laying in these graves with all their furnishings, and their tombs look like houses, but there's no evidence of where they lived. There's only dead people. And the archaeologists have been explaining these. They said, oh, they were very religious, and so they buried people in these. The only thing they did in the ancient world apparently would be build tombs and bury people in these elaborate graves, but there's no evidence of where they lived and how they lived. But in fact, the ancient world, by the way, when the graves are up on high land, you can see them exposed, like in these on Sinai right here, or here's the pyramids. When they're in low areas, they're covered up. There are pyramids in the delta of Egypt that's never been uncovered. But I know now that they were remodeled after the flood for tombs of the pharaohs, but they were actually built before the flood. So the last thing is the dispersion. I was able to see after this period of the early bronze, the middle bronze civilization spreads all over the world. This is the first map of Ham, Shem, and Japheth, which I was able to connect to the sons of Noah in Genesis chapter 10, and actually trace how they moved from the Near East to where Ararat is, and how Shem's people moved to China and into the New World, and even to parts of Africa, and here's Ham's people, and then here's Japheth's people. And very quickly, where did all this start? I was able to trace the beginnings of this to this archaeological culture, which had these round platforms, obviously for tents. They're using open fires. They're using a type of pottery that's a very distinctive pottery. I'm working in archaeology now, and it's spreading. This is a map from an Israeli archaeologist. They first identified this near the Sea of Galilee, and some of it's in Jericho. And it spreads all over. It spreads this way. It spreads into Iran. It spreads over into Georgia. And look where it begins. It begins up here near this river called the Araxes River and the Kura River up here north of Lake Van. And it's a region that the ancient people call, or the Syrians call, Urartu. The Bible translates it as Ararat, because that the Hebrew doesn't have vowels, but here is the land, and right in the middle of this ancient land is a mountain called Mount Ararat, and so this pottery begins. In fact, it begins right at the bottom of the mountain. So I've traced the flood, the beginning of a new dispersion after the flood, virtually to Mount Ararat with this kind of pottery. But I didn't have anything on the ark. The only thing that I'd heard that made sense was what I'd heard. There was a let me mention this. Well, what does the Bible say where the ark landed? Genesis 8 tells us where Noah's ark came to rest. It doesn't say Mount Ararat. Mount Ararat wasn't called that. And it does say the mountains of Ararat in Genesis 8 and 4. But it also says that the waters kept coming down, and the tops of the surrounding mountains were not visible until about 10 weeks later. So it has to be the highest place, the highest mountain in ancient Ararat. It's precisely the one spot where, according to the Bible, Noah's Ark has to be. It settled there. So we know it's important. If the Bible is true, the ark has to be on top of Mount Ararat. Now, you'll hear other people say differently, but they haven't computed the fact that it actually has to be on that. And in fact, in ancient times, Josephus says that the ark still resides on the highest mountain in Armenia, which is what Ararat is called today. But I finished my work, and I'm publishing the book, a 20-year investigation of the archaeological evidence of the flood, completed in 2010, and no mention of Noah's Ark in all my work, because I didn't want my scientific work compromised by some spurious claims that we hear, you know, quite frequently about the Ark. The only thing I did hear that caught my attention was this book called Walking the Bible. Bruce Fowler, writes for the New Yorker, and he had an archaeologist that I met independently of Parachute. He asked Parachute in this, it was made into a PBS miniseries, "I've heard that you have wood from the Ark, will you take me and show me the Ark?" And he said, first of all, he said, "Yes, I have the wood." And he said, "Would you show me the Ark?" And he says on this, this is still, it's not necessary to tell the people. Basically, he did not trust Bruce Fowler. The culture minister of that part of Turkey wanted him to guide, so they wanted tourists. But Parachute was not willing. He even offered him $10 million if he had shown the Ark. And finally he said, desperation, he said, "What if I tell you that my mother was dying and I need to tell her about the Ark?" And he says, only said, "Well, you can tell her the Ark is still exists and it's on the mountain." And that's all he would tell Bruce Fowler. This is, you can look this up on YouTube on Walking the Bible and actually hear that conversation. Then, as I was about to go to press with my book, I heard the announcement we're talking about from this Hong Kong group and from the group of, here's the Panda Lee, which Michael mentioned, and this was part of that, the announcement that I first heard. My mother was upstairs, and she said, "Philip, turn on ABC News, and Diane Sawyer is announcing this, making this startling announcement that appears that Noah's Ark has been found." And, of course, I'm just publishing this book, and this was really great news, and I'm ready to celebrate. But the very next day, Diane Sawyer says, "Well, you know, last night we told you about the discovery of what appeared to be Noah's Ark. Now we've learned that this is probably a hoax." And so I'm despondent, and because everything was matching up what I expected to see, and I'm very sorry, but I had to look into it because it was just too close. And I investigated both the charges against it and the actual discovery, and I put up a blog up, and basically I became the defender. The U.S. defender, and through them, they came to the United States, and to the apologetics conference in 2010. But and then I was up here, I think, talking about it at Grace Polaris in 2012. I still was not myself connected, but NAMI, the Chinese, were still working on the Ark, and then the NAMI was not able to get archaeologists involved. So at some point, I go to and meet the man who actually discovered it. His name is Ahmet Uğurlu, or we call him Parachute. It's his nickname. It's better known as just call him Parachute because there's a lot of Ahmets in that part of the world, but there's only one Parachute. I met him in January of 2013. He belongs to a prominent family of the mountain. His father was, when the Armenians were ran out of this part of Turkey, and they took over, the Turks took over the mountain. And there's a movie out now, The Promise, about the Armenian genocide. Well, this man's mother's family were part of those that fled. They lived on the mountain. And his father was a superintendent here when they were ran out. His father took over, but his grandfather and father married into the family, the Armenian family that lived on the mountain. And so when Parachute was going up, he heard these stories from his family about the ark, and he wants to, because the family are not in Turkey, but he wants to be to tell the world about that. And they said, well, when you're old enough, maybe, you know, we can tell you where to look. And so when I developed a relationship with him, and working with the American archaeologists to get them involved with this discovery, and believe me, they're well aware of it. I met with the top archaeological officials of this country, and a lot of them would really love to do it because it would bring archaeology back to life. But there's enormous prejudice in the academy against anything having to do with Noah's Ark. So bringing the rank and file in, it's probably been difficult to get them to publicly associate themselves. We're going to have this well-funded before we can get... I was helping Parachutes. We were just... you remember when ISIS was killing the people on the mountain, the Yazidis? Those were Parachutes people. They were Kurdish. And the ones that fled into the mountains of Turkey were not getting any attention. They were going to freeze to death in the mountain because America had this special relationship with Turkey and they didn't want to say anything about the Kurds having problems. But through working with him on the refugee crisis, he was able to convince his family that they could trust me, that I was, you know, had a real relationship with them. And November the 24th, I remember I was just out of the blue because I never asked to go visit this site. I didn't think I'm the person. I'm not the technical climber. But he said, Philip, we've got to get you on the mountain to wake everybody up. And it was a problem for me, even though I scientifically knew this was real. But when I had not actually been there, they could say that this man is using you or something like that. But I really needed to go there, and so I did go there. And then in last October or 2015, I actually brought Parachute to America with Dr. Belli, the Turkish archaeologist in charge. And there was a little piece on an interview with us, Dr. Geisler and I, on Fox News at that time, but we didn't have the archaeological work established, so we kind of pulled back the publicity on that until that work could be done. And we did. There was an archaeological organization formed to be able to do this work. And then, right after this, in 2015, the family decided that they would never meet with anyone. They wouldn't even meet with Nami, the Chinese. But somehow or another, they invited me, and I met this family that lived in this country that's not in Turkey, that have kept the secrets about this ark. The truth of the matter, it's never been lost. The family remembers, and the ark, it landed up here on the saddle of the mountain. This is a picture of the south side of the mountain on a very hot summer when a lot of the snow has melted away. And the ark used to be right up here, but after years, it got covered up with snow and ice because it's an ice-covered mountain. And but people had visited it. There was ways that they could get down there. But in 1840, the earthquake, that's why you see the mountain. It's actually the earthquake knocked this part of the South Mountain down, and the glacier and everything that was in the glacier, including this ship, came down. The ship, though, broke into several pieces, and these are not the exact locations, but there are three major locations of the ship, and then there are scattered wreckage between, and I'm actually going to visit this location here, location B, part of the ship, and this most of Nami went into this location, too. I have not been in the location A, which is in better shape, which is where Parachute and Panda Lee has actually been in location A, but no one else. when we're over there, we have, I was sending out a newsletter, which Michael got, some others got, but somehow or another, the wrong people got this, and when we were flying over there after they got the site prepared, there was a group of climbers, very, one of them very rough looking, that were flying with us to the same site. And my archaeological partner, she recognized that we had a problem when we got to the airport. Parachute meets us. He said, "We've got a problem." And so the ones that were flying with us, they went up and set by our high camp site to film us. You know, they're wanting to get the location, so we can't go there. So we had to spend a few weeks there looking. But I did get to see everything around the area from parachute, all the important things in going to Iran and Nachivan and Armenia, that part of it. And eventually, our team on the mountain, they kept moving it, and the spy team kept following them, and finally they just moved their tent over by the spy team, and then they came off. Right after they came off, a storm came up, and Parachute calls me, you know, like 5 o'clock in the morning. He says, "I've got to get to the mountains. The men can't survive. The tent was gone. They have to run down the mountain to stay alive." And I've got photos of him picking them up, and then we had to get a new tent made. So I'm not an Indiana Jones person, but we had everything involved, rival teams trying to find the ark, and even having to evade the spies. But he calls me, and I'm thinking, well, it's not going to happen. You know, and I didn't want to come home because I had tied everything to this, and we'd spent a lot of money, and we lost our film crew for the delays, and we just had enough, and we were able to persuade the climbers to go back and open it up. And but I didn't think it was going to happen because we've been over there for 3 weeks, and I'm saying, oh my goodness, you know, now everybody's going to think that, you know, I've just been used. And then when I gave up, I got a call from Parachute. He's on the mountain. He said, "Where are you?" And I said, "We're here in the hotel." And he said, "Well, why aren't you on the mountain?" And so anyway, he said, "Well, I'm sending a band to get you." So we're getting in, and we're leaving that morning. And we're on the north side of the mountain. We're now coming up on the west side of the mountain. I take that photograph as we're driving up. Here, we're going to actually be going here. This is a cell tower. That you remember that canyon I showed you in the picture where the ark was? This is it right here. And where we're going is right near the top of the cell tower. So we go over and we transfer into the base of the mountain to a Land Rover, and then things really get rough. That's the most dangerous part of the whole journey, is riding on this Land Rover that's teeter-tottering. And but you see there's no trees or anything on the mountain, and we're still thousands of feet below where we're going, still no trees. So, but we keep going up as high as the Land Rover can take us, and then we transfer to horses because time's running out. We've got to get up there. So within about 6 hours, I'm going from 2,600 feet, which is on the north side of the mountain, which is lower, to right here, 14,000 feet. That's our new tent. And that's without acclimatization, that's climbing very fast. And this night I get very sick, and I don't sleep this entire night. And by the way, these lights right here, that's Iran. We're right there on the border of Turkey and Iran. But the next morning we started out, I'm a little sick, but, you know, we've got to move across the mountain, across this valley. Here's little Ararat in the distance. We're walking over. I walk very slowly. Finally, here's the site that we arrive at. And just to show you what it looks like from it, I told you that you could see the surrounding mountains when the ark landed. You see we're looking down on the mountains. We're up at I won't tell you exactly, but it's around 15,000 feet. It's higher than any place in the United States, continental United States, where we are right now. You can see this is Section B. Apparently, this part of the mountain, it slid horizontally into this mountain, and the rocks that have tumbled down and covered it up in the time since the earthquake, it's now buried 10, 20 feet down, and these rocks on top have apparently collapsed collapsed the top, the roof and the top deck. You know, the weight of that has collapsed the deck. And by the way, here's what it looked like when this site was first opened. You see the black covered walls and this board. I'm actually going to go back in there, but now these boards, a lot of them have water has gotten into the site due to us opening it, and it's washing some of these out. So there's environmental degradation that very much concerns us, especially concerns Parachute. He thinks he's responsible for destroying the ark, you know, because it's damages, but this is one section of it. So we go into this tunnel, and this is an archaeological official that I brought with me, and I was so sick. I get to the entrance, and Parachute says, "Who wants to go in first?" I was hoping that she would say that she would go in first, because I didn't think that I could go in. I didn't want to. I wanted to die. I was feeling so bad. But we were able to, first of all, we filmed her going in. And this is about 5 minutes. I'm going to let you watch this. We've lost our film crew, so it's kind of dark. And very dangerous if the ice melts and some of these rocks come down on the rope that's attached to her body is not really to help her climb, but so the body can be recovered if this collapses in, like can very likely happen. He just asked me to pray.
Thank you. scarce. To rozmawiamy. Weź kogoś tam gomorze nie sobie. Weź tam do...
To są gę.
Weź kogoś tam do... Kiedyś
powiem kiasę.
Yes, space between knees.
To the center.
And then to this small room.
Ten.
And you see the mother broken. Then, if you would, show the thickness of this one. Four?
Four. Seven, eight. Seven, eight. Seven, eight. Seven, eight. Seven, eight. Seven,
eight. Seven, eight. Seven, eight. Seven, eight. Seven, eight. Seven, eight. Seven,
eight.
Seven, eight. Yeah. Now we can let Phil come in.
Check.
I miraculously recovered. By the way, this is looking down on the lower deck, and we can look up and see that there is another floor above us. And this is the one place that they had discovered where they could actually see the structure of how it was built. Everybody was very excited when this part was open. And here again is, are those walls that are actually bowed, but you can see the planking behind them. And these planks are held together. By the way, here's the brace that goes into the wall. And you can see this is Parachute's hand, and do you see this looks like paint or something is dripped on here? You remember the blackened wall I showed you in the photograph a few minutes ago? It has dripped on the inner bracing, so this could very well be the pitch that Noah covered the ark with. This is dripping here on the braces. And this is my hand, and because I was sick and I had left all my scientific tools, and I wanted something to be able to get a measure perspective, so I used my hands. And here Doubting Thomas has his hands on the wooden nails that held the structure together. That's Parachute and me, hermeneutical Parachute, who has discovered the archaeological evidence of Noah's Ark, has partnered with the one who has discovered the archaeological evidence of the flood. It's very strange that we would be we know each other's families. You know, we really, really. I had to investigate him, so I have to, you know both his mother's family and his father's family, and of course he knows my family as well. And by the way, I have a photograph of this with those two pictures of our hands. If some of you that want them, I think Jim Custer has made some photographs that you can get from some of us. Now, the only last thing I'm going to leave you with is the family that has kept the secrets. Here is the Mount Ararat right here. And these are the Kura-Araxes River, the river that runs just to the north of the mountain, and the Kura River where this archaeological spread begins that I've traced. And of course, down here, by the way, this is the Euphrates, the Tigris River. Here's the Euphrates River, and Nineveh is right here, but we're right here at Mount Ararat. But I believe that Noah lived up here in Georgia between the Caspian and the Black Sea, and the ark was actually built here. When the ark landed here on Mount Ararat, they go home. And it's the same direction, apparently, as his family fled in the Armenian genocide. And they had never met anyone, and they agreed to talk to me. So we went up the Republic of Georgia. The capital is Tbilisi. Beautiful city. Here's the Kura River. And I met with the family. There's one woman that remembers living on the mountain. She's 102 years old, and she lives by herself with her cows in the High Caucasus Mountains. And by the way, here are the archaeologists. He's with the Leiden Museum in Holland. He's a key member of the Dead Sea Scroll team, one of the most prominent archaeologists in Israel. And this man is the head of the Archaeological Association in the Republic of Georgia. And Professor Belli's not in this picture, but he is, of course, the world expert on this region. He's basically the Turkish official archaeologist on the discovery. And here we're filming. This is the photographer was filming the lady. Here she is, the 102-year-old lady. Here's Parachute. And these are members of the family, except for Clara Way here and my interpreter. And here I am with her. And that's how we knew, or how Parachute knew where to look, as his family gave him the information to do this. And so I'll just leave it right here. Open it up for questions. Environmentally or from looters? When we left there, they covered this site up where you could walk right past it and not know. In fact, the main trail is near there. And the main thing is protected. No one's going to get to this site because the PKK will not let them, and the Turkish government will not let them. And you can only search on Mount Ararat for the ark where you want to search. So no one is going to find this that's an outsider. But there's still possibility, if the locals knew where this was, that looting could be involved. You just couldn't stop it because these pieces would be so valuable. So there's only a handful of people that actually know where the site is. You've actually seen this location. That's why I didn't want any photographs made of this, because it could be identified. And of course, we want to take archaeologists there. When the funding in the museum is there, the security will be funded as well. Now, we have to rely on the people to do it, to keep things secure. That was a good question. Yes?
Are parts of it petrified wood,
or is it wood? It's not petrified, but interesting, the water running through this has a mineral content, so it has a very interesting feel. It's not petrified wood, but neither is it regular wood. And by the way, on these boards that you were looking at, if you notice, the growth rings on these were perfectly even. You don't have that in wood, you know, trees, the seasons, one season you got different size. And the scientists that have looked at this wood, they've never seen anything like that, which indicates that the seasons were probably different then. By the way, there's never been wood from this area back in the 90s, they found a man in the Italian Alps that actually dates to the same period, Ötzi the Ice Man, and he was frozen in the glacier. This has also been frozen in the glacier at a higher altitude and better protected than Ötzi. So this is the greatest amount of organic artifacts, meaning wood and leather and clay. Everything has been well preserved by being well frozen. So no one has really ever seen any wood from this area. It was very advanced. There are ships that were found beneath the pyramids that used the same kind of construction, this mortise and tendon, there's no iron that we've seen associated with this. The ship is apparently put together with these pegs. There had to be tens of thousands of these wooden pegs, and they all seem to be hewn. How do they make these square holes and square wooden pegs? The labor seems to be incredible. I mean, and the ingenuity, you know, a lot of technology was lost with this great catastrophe called Noah's flood. The world was really a rather advanced world that existed at the time. Yes? Yes.
Secondly, you have not mentioned that anybody's looked into Section A.
Section A, at carbon 14 dating first. Yes, some of this wood has been dated to 4,800 years ago, which the trees have to grow, and that would be about right for that time. And even some of, I think, Navarra, the Frenchman that found some wood, actually dated about the same time. We don't have our own archaeologists dated the wood yet. I date it by pottery. The pottery I traced to it dated to the early Bronze Age, which is about 4,300 years ago. And there were white pellets that some of you may have seen from Nami's video. And we've recently had a paleobotanist identify these as Paleolithic chickpeas that are not seen anywhere today. But that dates it to, again, about the time of Noah. An interesting thing about chickpeas, which appeared to be the main, there was a lot of these, is any animal can eat this, including human beings. It's very diverse. It explains a lot about the food that may have been involved in. There's just so much that can be learned when we have the geneticists and the biologists and the full team, working around the clock, doing investigation. What this is, this will transform biology. It will transform botany. It will transform archaeology. It will transform geology. It will just totally change the way. Yes.
So you did see clay pots in the ark?
Yes, there's clay pots in the ark. And there's pottery that dates from a period after the ark, so there's been people visiting this structure, for thousands of years. We found a pottery there from the Gaza pottery from the Islamic era, from the Byzantine era. So there's evidence that people have been going to this site. But then how did this pottery from the early Bronze Neolithic era, because people back then they didn't even know really what this pottery was. But when I saw this pottery, pictures of this pottery, I said, there's my pottery. I didn't dream that the ark was still in existence until I learned about this. And then I said, wouldn't it be wonderful if we would actually find the pottery that I've traced to this mountain would actually be found in this vessel? Yes, go ahead.
So you're currently fundraising.
Well, we need to do private fundraising. We've done some private fundraising to do some of the preliminary archaeological studies. But yes, we're going to have to do some fundraising. But we probably need to get a little bit of buzz out to get the private investors connected. There are people that will fund this privately. In fact, Parachute says, he said, Philip, you need to get some your own funding and get an organization, that can do the message. I'm working independently of the archaeologists. Both Parachute and I have worked. We want to get the archaeologists involved, but we're not speaking for the archaeologists. We refuse to do that. They need to be completely independent. Yes. Yeah, a gopher wood. Yeah, it's what gopher wood is. The wood appears to be something like cypress oak. It has a reddish color to it. Gopher wood could actually mean manufactured wood or worked wood. We don't know really what gopher really means. Or it could be the species of wood that was in here. But whatever gopher wood is, you saw my hand on gopher wood. If this is Noah's Ark, and I'm not saying it's Noah's Ark, I'm going to give you the results of my investigation. But the archaeologists will try to discover was it built up there on the mountain? If it was built up there, it's hard to understand how it could be built up there. But we will find evidence of it being of this construction site, the roads, and the build of something like this. You certainly couldn't have carried it up there. So the question is, was it built up there or did it float there? And that's the way I approach it, I'm going to try to prove this is not Noah's Ark. If I can't approve, like I tried to prove that the flood wasn't there, and it ends up, if I can't prove that it was not, and if I can connect this to the spread of people, then we really do know that it's Noah's Ark. And yes?
You said early on in your presentation, you showed yourself with Ken Ham and his team.
Yes.
Are they involved in?
No, they're not involved. I was taking the greetings from Parachute to Ken Ham. And there's possibilities, but can I not speak about those because these are, I don't want to compromise anyone. But I would say that, you know, a lot of the people in Ken Ham's organization don't believe that this mountain could have existed at the time of Noah. And they're very skeptical, but a lot of people will not be able to go to Turkey to visit this. And Ken Ham has a wonderful organization, and it would really do wonders, really, for everybody. But it wouldn't help a lot for Ken Ham to be involved in the exploration. And it wouldn't help him. It wouldn't help us. It'd be better for the archaeologists to come and give us that information. Yes.
Is this the same area? Same
area.
And my second question is, the records for that were destroyed, I understand. They didn't want them to be known.
Right.
If you could elaborate.
Well, you know, why the family has not talked about this or revealed this information, the Russians and the Soviets were controlling the mountain up until, and now then the Turks have, and America has been supporting the Turkish government. So that has really made them very, very nervous about letting people know where this is. Some of these sites, satellite photographs, you know, are probably not it. About the Russian expedition, I'm not sure. I do know absolutely that when Ed Davis visited this site from Iran in 1944, when he was stationed in Iran, he's an American, he saw the same thing that I saw, and the same people that took him there took me there. We're the only ones that have seen this, and we were both invited. Yes. Ed Davis, there is a book written by another man called Painful Mountain. I'm trying to think of the author of this that has his account. And the account is also, it's been his interview, he's dead now, but the interview with him has been filmed. And I have a copy of the video, but you could probably also find it on the web, Ed Davis and him sharing. Painful Mountain, I think. Yeah.
And my other was, won't the government prevent you all from doing investigation if they find out it becomes known?
No, we're not ARC searchers. We work with the government. We have to get about half a dozen permissions from the National Park Service, the local governor, the Turkish military, and we have to work with other people, with the PKK. So basically, we're official. The archaeologists you saw in the pictures, they're the official, some of them are government officials, and some of them, yes. Yes.
Did you find any artifacts in addition to the pottery?
Oh, yes, there are a lot of artifacts. The family artifacts have also been scattered with the family when they left, so we want to gather these artifacts back. They're, in addition to pottery, there's leather, there's... I don't want to mention this, but there's possibly some even very, very interesting things that have text in them. By the way, this is where the Sumerians come from, which is named for Shem, but the ancient language begins here in Georgia and spreads to Mesopotamia. This is really going to change the biblical handbooks. Everything you know about the ancient Near East and Bible times, this is going to really change it. But it's going to change it in a very simple way, just using the light of the Bible to look at the evidence.
Thank you. You're welcome.
You're welcome as long as he is able to stand in that place to come visit. But many of you are in tight schedules. I have mentioned, and these are for folks that would like to have one and who will promise to pray. You don't promise to pray? Forget it. And if you want, seriously, if you want a copy of the book, it's here.
Yeah, one of these books is Henry Neeson's. He's got the story of NAMI's involvement. It's the best book. My book, if you want really scientific stuff, then my book is also available. But we want your prayers is really what we came here for. And of course, we have this relationship with Columbus that because you've invited us from the beginning, and Michael is really a member of the core team that have of Americans that have been faithful to this. It's like a little family. And,
okay,
yeah.
Since you didn't set the price. The price is $69.75 per book.
$34.95 for my book, and I think $39.95 for Henry's Andre's book. Yeah.
Here?
Yeah.
What was it?
$34.95 for my book.
$34.95 for his book. That's the one.
Yeah, and then Henry Nation's book is $39.95. Or if there's a brochure, if you want to take that instead of getting the book, you come pick up a brochure on the book. It's got that map of the dispersion on one of the little brochures. Yeah.
Mike will be in charge of that. I'm going to take these and go out there. So as you leave, if you want one of these and you promise to pray, it is a very good picture. You saw it on the screen, and it's a very good picture. It has the combination. These two brothers that are pictured together have an enormous responsibility, enormous task. They need much prayer. And there's a tremendous issue involved. And then the Lord part is the picture of the pig with the modern Thomas looking at.
Doubting Thomas. Doubting Philip.
Of his hand and a picture of our brother's hand, turkey. I'll have these out in the lobby if you want one as you leave. I'm going to ask you to do one more thing. Would you please come up and lead us in prayer? Please?
Yeah.
And pray for those things that you want us to pray for.
What?
Would you do that? Come on up and pray.
Thank you.
And why don't you stand as you lead us in prayer? God bless. Thanks for coming.
Thanks
for
being
here. Yeah.
Bless your heart.
Yeah. Lord, we're just so thankful to be here among brothers and sisters and friends. You said Abraham was your friend. You said before Abraham was, I am. And Lord, this concerns the nations, the Gentiles that come from Noah's family, Lord. And you said that you would not return until the gospel goes to all the nations. And Lord, we just ask that that happen, that you have preserved for just such a time as this will reignite the gospel to all nations for our own times, Lord. And we're just so thankful to be with the folks of Columbia here in Columbus that are like part of the family that has been faithful to this mission. And we give you the thanks and the praise, and we ask this in your name. Amen.
The woman that was sitting here in the dark hair, she's from Turkey.
So really?
She was telling us things that was being said up there.
Oh,
she
wow.
Yes. Yeah, so
wonderful.
Question you didn't
she's
answer.
She's a new believer.
What about Section A? Is that
I didn't answer
get
Section
to
A.
It yet, or?
That's like the crown jewels, and
looks
parachute
like
has
largest,
not taken me there
it
yet.
It looks like the largest section. It,